We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Hey, good morning, Doug Sinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. Just call 260-1870, or you can text us on our Facebook page, Nico and Sinceri, and we'll be glad to respond to your question. Good morning, Albert.
Hey, Doug, what's going on this morning?
Oh, man, was some rough basketball yesterday. Did you watch LSU and Pelicans?
No, I heard LSU blew it at the end, and I did not watch the Pelicans. We were out to dinner.
The Tigers were up 71-64 with about 48 seconds left. And
what?
Yeah, they were up by seven. And they
Texas turned it over.
They did everything. It was 2 3-pointers,
oh, really?
Turned it over, fouled. They hit LSU had 12 points in the last, I believe, minute. And Texas Tech was ranked, I think they were ranked 15th or 10th. I mean, they're a gritty team. They're a very, very good team. And
yeah.
LSU, you know, they just fell apart. I mean, it was just inexplicable.
Wow.
So that was sort of a heartbreak.
I mean, did they miss shots or did they do both?
Well, they didn't defend on the three. On an inbound pass, they didn't defend on the three. They turned the ball over twice. Texas Tech hit a 3-pointer to pull within one, they threw the inbound pass after the make to Texas Tech, and they scored a layup, and they went up by one. They came back down again. They missed a shot. Texas Tech scored, I think, two more times. So it ended up being a 12-0 run in the last minute. So
48 seconds.
40, yeah. So I think it was just brutal. It was probably one of the worst loss, disappointing loss in LSU history. But they have a fatal flaw. They had, Darius Days had filed out, and their other star filed out. But I think the problem with LSU, much like the Pelicans, we have similar problems. They do not have a point guard who can penetrate, because they just don't have, you know, a lot of great teams that win at the end. When the Pelicans, or at the time the Hornets, had Chris Paul, we won a lot of games in the last minute because you'd have somebody who'd be able to penetrate and then kick and get that easy basket.
With LSU, that's not going to do with the basketball, too. And you're going to have somebody that's not going to do something stupid with the ball.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think LSU doesn't have anybody who's a true point guard. They sort of play out on the perimeter, and they can't kick and, you know, they can't penetrate and kick it out and shoot. Same thing with the Pelicans. They don't have a real true point guard. They have a bunch of shooting guards who don't penetrate, and if they're not hitting the three-pointer, they're not going to, you know, that's the whole key. If they're hitting the three-pointer, they'll win. If they're not, they're going to lose. And so, you know, it was just one of those, you know, it was just tough. But I think with LSU, you had, Javonte Smart. He's really a two guard. and he's bringing the ball point. And then there's, you know, they have Cam Thomas, who's could be a superstar, but he's a two guard. And a couple of years ago, when LSU had, you know, they had who's it, Trey, the point guard who would LSU won a lot of games at the end because, you know, you're able to penetrate and kick it out, or, you know, penetrate and kick it to, you know, and get a easy layup. But I think that's a fatal flaw of LSU. I think they'll may make the NCAA. They may make a tournament. They may even win a game, possibly. But they just don't have a true point guard. That's the same with the Pelicans. Pelicans started out fast last night. Let's see, they beat two nights ago. They beat Milwaukee. Milwaukee's got one of the best records in the East. And then they came back against Houston. They started fast. They were up by 12 in the, I think, first and second quarter, and they collapsed after that. But also, the Pelicans, if they're not hitting the three-point shot to open up the middle, there's nobody to penetrate at this point. You know, you don't have a Chris Paul.
The Pelicans don't have that alpha dog. You know, they every team in the league, you know, you got your Doncic, you got your LeBron, you got your Harden. You know, all these guys are the guy. You know, I'm going to get it to you, and you're going to do the right thing with the ball. You're going to, you know, drive and dish. You're going to shoot. We're going to set you up. And the Pelicans don't have that. You know, Brandon Ingram's a great shooter, great player, but I don't think he has the leadership skills, you know, and I think they were hoping to get a little bit out of Redick for that.
But Redick's hit. Yeah, he's not even shooting. I don't think he's shooting 30%.
Yeah. So I'm just talking about the leadership, you know, and I think bringing Adams in helped, you know, but he's just been around a long time. He's not a guy, because it's a very young team, and he's not a guy that's going to take control of a game, and that's really what we don't have. And the teams that are successful in the NBA have that kind of player. And look, Anthony Davis was not that type of player. Anthony Davis was a great player, but he wasn't the guy that's going to get in the huddle and say, give me the ball. I want to go win this game.
Well, yeah.
And so, you know, and now he's got LeBron that's still that guy, and that's why they're successful, because they have somebody that is, you know. And LeBron's game has stepped up tremendously because he doesn't think he has to do it all anymore. So he's looking for triple-doubles now, you know, and not just to score 40.
See, I think the key, it's just me, which is my opinion. This is a lawyer on Sunday morning, which is worth nothing
when it
comes to basketball. But my opinion is you need a good point guard. And, like, when the Pelicans were successful, we had Chris Paul at the end of the game.
Drew Holiday was.
No, that's why we didn't have successful. I mean, I think we had two guards. We didn't have a true one playing. Now, the Pelicans did pick Kira Lewis, who's a rookie out of Alabama. He's probably, you know, he's probably will have a redshirt year this year.
I can't think of his name, the guy with the hyphenated name.
Nicola. He is Nickeil Alexander Walker. He's a two guard. He's a great shooter, but I mean he does some penetration. He's not your true port. He's sort of a hybrid. He's much like Drew Holiday. He's a hybrid 1-2. He's good. Now he's good. And I think he's going to get a lot of playing time, because I think a guy like Redick, a la, you know, Drew Brees, once you hit a certain age, which he's 37, when your skills diminished or drop off, they drop off a cliff. And I think he's shooting under 30% from the three-point line, and that's why they have him as a three-point line. He's 37 years old, been in the league for 15 years. So, you know, he's good, but it's just, you know, the time is, you know, catching up with him a little bit.
And he's the defense guy.
Yeah, yes. He's in there for 18 minutes, you know, see if he can pick up, you know, spread out the defense. But, so, you know, LSU had 2 years ago, when they were doing so well and won SEC, they had Tremont Waters, who is, I think, with the Celtics now. And he could penetrate. He could and make a lot of easy shots. Now, if you have five guys playing on the perimeter The whole key is whether you make three-point shots. Now, you're going to be hot on three-point shots once every four games. The other three games is just going to be average at best, one out of four or five. And you'll win that one out of four or five game like they get against the Bucks. But when you're not hitting from three-point, and then you hit, if you have a point guard who can go in, make penetration, get a few easy baskets, or even dish to get a lot of easy baskets for your big men, I think that's a difference. So, you know, LSU this year, they got five great players, six or seven great, really good players, but they're not playing as a team and no point guard.
Yeah.
And I think Pelicans probably are going to go away from, they'll probably keep Bledsoe. They're going to probably, they got to decide what they want to do with Lonzo, Ball, because he's maddening.
Yeah,
he is maddening. He scored 25 points the other night. He was fantastic. And then he disappears the next game, which
and turns the ball over.
Right. And he's not a true point guard either. He's sort of a hybrid. And so I think, you know, the Pelicans probably will start going to their younger guards because that's the future. But also, Matt Stafford will not be a New Orleans Saint.
No, right.
So the L.A. Rams went full Super Bowl on that one. A couple of first-round picks, a third-round pick, and Jared Goff, which they were glad to offload because I think Jared Goff's cap number is bigger than Stafford's. So I think the Rams are now suddenly the number one Super Bowl contender in the NFC next year. But I think Jameis Winston's going to be our starter this time next in September.
For financial.
Yeah, cap reasons. No question.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I guess we'll talk a lot. I have a few topics I want to talk about. One is
I actually do too. Let's get back to it. We can talk a little longer.
So this is Doug Cinzeri, Albanico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinzeri, Albanico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. Albert, there's a trend in since we would say in Bucktown, the COVID societal trends, you know, habits change. And one of the habits that are changing are people are investing more money in their home and less money because there's less money for, you know, travel, eating out. But they still have a desire to entertain. And so a lot of people are adding to their house. If you go around, there's a lot of people who are doing a lot of additions and a lot of people doing outdoor kitchens, which is sort of a deal because, you know, people want to go out, used to go out to eat. And, they can have people over without, you know, some bureaucrat wagging a finger at them and sort of have things the way they, you know, would feel comfortable doing things. And so I'm also seeing, and I just had this last week, somebody called and said, I'm doing an addition on my house. I gave the contractor $80,000. It's a $130,000 job. It's not in writing, but we have a disagreement as to what work is, you know, the $80,000 covered and, you know, what work is to be completed. And so I know you talk a lot about this, but like if you're doing a outdoor kitchen or you're doing some type of renovation for your house or you're adding to it so that you know, your home will be more entertainment friendly because you're not going out as much, you know, you just don't, you know, shake hands with, you know, a remodeler or a contractor and say, hey, let's, you know, have at it. So what are some of the things that a homeowner can do who wants to maybe, you know, do outdoor kitchen, remodel, add extra room, given the fact that they're probably home more?
The first thing you obviously want to do is check on, do a little background check, and don't even take a referral from a friend. That was wonderful, and those are great, but you can go to a website. It's Louisiana State Board for Contractors. And then it says search for contractors tab. And make sure that person is licensed. It's a very simple step. Make sure his company or the person that you're dealing with has a license. Secondly, you want to make sure that it's in your contract that all of the trades, everything will be inspected, and permits will be filed, and they'll all be inspected. Your plumbing, your heating, your air conditioning, I mean, or your electricity, everything is going to be filed and inspected by the parish. The next thing you want to do is put some language in the contract that states that all subcontractors required by law to be licensed shall be licensed, which means that your foundation contractor by law has to be licensed. Your framing contractor has to be licensed. Your roofing contractor, your stucco contractor, if you have stucco. So all of these folks have to be licensed, and if they're not, you know, that actually the contractor's at fault, because he's required by law to maintain copies of the licenses of his subcontractors for 3 years.
Sure
they have, right?
Yeah.
So now, that doesn't mean you're going to get great, you know, work, because they got guys probably that are not licensed that can perform great work. What it's going to do is it's going to make sure at least that you're covered, you're legal. Anyone that has a home builder's license, they have to take a test. They have to take a test on code. They have to take, you know, so it's more than just sign your name, get your license, right? So you had a question or comment?
Yeah, well, I guess one of the misconceptions is, if you have a contractor who's licensed, some people believe that you don't need subs who are licensed. And so, it's probably pretty obvious to be able to determine, you know, if a sub's licensed, if, you know, there's a lot of external factors that would make that very apparent. I'll leave it at that without getting in trouble.
Correct. Well, I'm pursuing somebody right now. The guy's a licensed contractor. He's been building homes for 30 years. And we, you know, the house has numerous defects, and we started doing some digging. Well, the foundation contractor, the roofing contractor, the framing contractor, none of them were licensed. So he's just got these jacklegs out there doing it as cheap as he can get it. And, you know, when I talk to guys who are licensed, they said, look, when you're licensed, you've got to show proof of insurance. You've got to, you know, maintain your license. You have some duties to the board that you have to comply with. And so, you know, he said it's probably a 20 or 30% hit that I got to take, because I've got to pay for the license, pay for the insurance, pay for the workers' comp. And, you know, you've got to be sure that all of those folks have that insurance to make sure that you're covered. And part of that is, you know, if you're licensed, then they have to have the insurance.
Well, the legitimate, I'll say, the compliant contractors don't, you know, feel at a disadvantage, because they follow the rules. And there is probably a 20 or 30% markup for following the rules. And then they have maybe contractors who are unlicensed using unlicensed or even, you know, undocumented workers who can undercut the price. And, also, too, if yeah,
thing
go ahead.
You can do is you can have, as you know, I'm the attorney for the State Board of Home Inspectors, right? I know a lot of those guys that perform home inspections, and 99% of home inspections are performed in relation to resale of residential property. And so, you know, when you go to buy a house, you get it inspected before you purchase it, right? But they also inspect new homes, and they can do it in stages. So they'll go do a framing inspection, and they'll grab the architectural plans, and they'll go up in the attic, and they'll look at, you know, hey, this was not framed according to plan, or this was not done right, or this was not supported right. Or they'll, you know, put their stamp of approval on it and say, yes, it was, it's good to go on to the next step. And so those kinds of things help you. And, you know, you might spend another $500, $600, $700 to get that done. But it will help you in the long run because it's going to show, you know, as the stages of the house are completed, they're going to come in and say, yeah, look, they did this right. They did that right, and they did this right.
Now, also, too, if you're doing a small renovation, let's say like an outdoor kitchen, which, you know, may go anywhere from, you know, $10,000 to $100,000, anywhere in between, should you still do a contract even though it's maybe not a large renovation?
You want a contract for anything. You know, what am I paying for? How much up front? What are you going to do? Give me your scope of work, because what always happens is you really have an agreement with somebody, right? You kind of know what you want, and they know what you want. Oh, man, look, and on the way in, they're saying, yeah, man, I got it. We're going to take care of this. We'll have you totally finished. You're going to love it. Well, next thing you know, oh, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to put that in. You got to get somebody else to do that. Or I didn't talk about appliances. Y'all, you're going to have to put the appliances in. You're going to have to do. So make sure all of those things are done up front. You know, how many outlets do you want out there? You know, is that in the contract? Do we have a plan drawn for it? You know, and it seems like such a small, even if it's a rudimentary plan, it doesn't have to be an architectural plan, but it just has to look, I want this here. And then you know exactly what you're getting. You call out your finishes, you know, the type of brick or the type of stone or, you know, whatever the case may be. And, I mean, just spend a few hours on the front end getting it all done right, or a day or two getting it right, and then there's no dispute at the end. This is what you were supposed to do, and they can't say, oh, wait, you know, that was your job, or I wasn't supposed to do that, or, you know, I wasn't supposed to use this, I was supposed to use that.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. What about timelines, and how do you deal with timelines on both sides as far as the time of, you know, should you put a timeline in a contract, and what are some legitimate reasons that the time, you know, what the consequences of not having that timeline complied with? And we'll talk about that after the break. And also, you know, some of the,
we can talk about completion dates, things like that.
Okay. All right. So let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert, Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert, Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. Albert, we were talking a little bit about some of the trends in getting a little feedback here. Some of the trends about since COVID, as far as you know, a lot of people investing in their home because they're not maybe taking vacations and doing some other activities that they normally do, or entertainment type activities, so they want to bring the activities to their home. And one of the things that you know, people are doing, you know, putting outdoor kitchens or additions to the house to make it more entertainment friendly. And we're talking a little bit about the fact that, you know, when you do hire a contractor, you want to have a contract, and we're talking about completion dates. And, you know, what are some of the provisions you could put in a contract for renovation to make sure that it gets done on time? And what would be the consequences that you could put in the contract if it doesn't?
So what you do is you talk to your contractor on the front end, and you say, realistically, how long is this going to take? You know, from start to finish, assuming everything goes well and maybe even a couple of little hiccups. And they will give you an answer, and they're going to give you an answer that you probably want to hear, you know, that you know, we can get it done 3 weeks. We can get, you know, depending on the scope of the work, right? So say, well, look, how about if I gave you an extra week or two, and we put a completion date in the contract, and then if you don't finish it by that date, then we get what's called liquidated damages. It's going to start costing you, you know, depending on the value of the job, it's going to start costing you $300 a day, $150 a day, $200 a day, whatever y'all can come up with. And that might make, you know, might scare them off a little bit, but it's going to let them know that, hey, look, I got a deadline, you know, and I'm going to get to your work first. I'm not going to send my guys to five different other jobs and then, you know, let you sit around with your backyard all torn up if you're doing an outdoor kitchen, or you're worse than that, your interior of your home all torn up. So make sure that, you know, you have some protections with a nice little hammer at the end. And of course, you know, like anything, it's all negotiable, right? Well, no, we'll do $100 a day, or we'll do whatever. And you want to just make sure that they understand that it's important that you get this done timely.
We got a text from Kevin who said one of the first and easiest threshold to determine whether the contractors are properly insured is to ask for insurance certificates where they name each other's additional insureds. He indicated that his last two guys volunteered those insurance certificates up front to put that issue to rest.
So, no question. You want to make sure and look for the workers' comp insurance. Look for both the workers' comp and the general liability insurance.
Now, we had an interesting case and back not too long ago where a contractor actually gave a false insurance certificate and a false license. Work was done on the home. It was a hardworking couple in the city who took their retirement investment and invested it in rental property. That was their 401k.
Right.
And they had a undocumented worker say he got hurt. And they sued the contractor. The contractor didn't have insurance, wasn't licensed. So the homeowner ended up defending the claim. And
right, the workers' comp claim.
Yeah, the workers' comp claim. And he
right.
He'd indicated that he'd fallen off a roof. Now, there was a question on how many roofs has he fallen over and whether that roof was one of the roofs that he did fall upon just based on when we got his medical records. He had multiple names, multiple Social Security numbers, and multiple dates of accident. But that's
right.
But that was another issue. But, you know, the homeowner had to defend that case and ended up having to pay some money out to get rid of the claim.
Right.
But, you know, the homeowner, if you're not insured properly, the homeowner is going to be responsible for if anything happens there. And if somebody gets hurt, that could be substantial.
Exactly. Yeah, no, insurance, absolutely. Insurance is very important. You want to be named on the policy and be a certificate holder. So, in other words, if it's a long project that's going to take some time, you know, 8, 10, 12 months, you want to be a certificate holder. And what that means is, the insurance company will notify you in the event of any changes or lapses of coverage. And so if, you know, they all of a sudden reduce their limits or they change their coverage to something else or it lapses, then the insurance company will notify you, hey, look, they don't have insurance. And so you can get back on, you know, get back to your contract and say, I need a certificate of insurance or you're off the job.
Before we go to our next break in a couple of minutes, just talk a little bit about progress payments and how is that addressed in the contract.
Well, again, that's usually negotiated ahead of time as well. If it's finance, the bank a lot of times will, kind of get involved with that contract and make sure that the contractor is not too far ahead of the homeowner. And the homeowner should do the same thing. Make sure that the contractor is not too far ahead of him, meaning that, you know, we're going to give you a little bit up front once we sign it, but then we're going to have, you know, let's say you're building a new home. When the foundation is poured, we're going to give you X amount. When the framing is complete and the windows are in and the roof is wrapped, you know, it's called blacked in. When it's blacked in, we're going to give you X. And then just kind of give you an idea. Let the contractor give you a schedule of values. How much they anticipate paying for the foundation, for the framing, for this, for that. And so then you have a good idea of what these things are going to cost. Because if there's a dispute between you and the homeowner, you and the contractor, you don't want to be so far into him where he's got a substantial amount of your money, and then you terminate him. And now you have the burden of having to go get your money back. And so, you know, you've got to go sue him to get your money back. Instead of if you're, you know, about even or maybe even a little ahead of him, like I'm holding back these last few payments until you're done. you know, and always hold back 10% at the end for punch list items, for corrective items, you know, and because what happens is if the contractor reaches what's called substantial completion, basically the home is capable of being lived in, it meets its purpose, but there's some minor little defects or some punch list items that need to be completed, then you've got to get him incentive to come back to the job, to finish up, look, the hardware is not right, or the doors, the cabinet doors are crooked, or, you know, just these little minor items. You didn't finish the garden lights or whatever the case may be. And those types of things are more likely to get done if you're holding 10% of the contract. And then he'll come in and get it all finished so he can collect that money. But if he's already been paid in full, good luck. You know, you're relying on his good name, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with contractors, so many of them, they have a cell phone and a truck. You know, so if you go file suit against them, you know, and they shut their business down, what do they have?
They open up under another name.
You know?
Or they open, a lot of times they open up under another name.
And, right.
And have a little insulation
for which
that.
The contractors board's been pretty keen on, and they're, you know, if you bring something to him, say, hey, look, this guy did X, Y, Z to me, and now he's opened up in a new name, they'll investigate him and possibly shut him down. So, and look, you contractors out there, listen, because if you form an LLC and you perform some act that is against the law, right? For instance, not hiring licensed subcontractors or not obtaining permits. There was just a case out of the Fourth or Fifth Circuit that basically said this guy promised that he filed for a permit. He told the homeowner, oh, absolutely. And he had text messages showing that you know, he said that. Well, he didn't. So what happened was they filed suit against his LLC and they filed suit against him personally. And the Court of Appeals said, yeah, if you're going to misrepresent something and of course, and you're going to violate the law, which, you know, doing this type of work without a license, I'm sorry, without a permit is against the law, then we're going to let him go, let the plaintiffs go after you personally, and we're going to pierce the veil of the LLC. So, you know, contractors, beware, be very careful. You want to do things by the books. And the more people that do it by the book are going to, you know, make it a better place for us to all have contracting work done. And, you know, it levels the playing field in terms of the costs.
Okay. All right. I hear the music. Let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. On until 10 o'clock. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We were talking, got about 3 minutes before the national news and local news. We sort of spoke this hour about, you know, a lot of people doing renovations because COVID, they're not going out, so they're entertaining at home, wanted to make their home a little more entertainment friendly. And, you know, we got about 3 minutes, and Albert's been talking about, you know, if you have a deal to have a renovation, with some of the things you should do with contractors. Anything else, Albert, in the last couple of minutes you think, you know?
Well, if you're building a new home, it's a totally different ball game than in a renovation. But if you're building a new home, you want to consider the New Home Warranty Act. And I got some radio spots on that. But basically, with the New Home Warranty Act, there are a lot of things that the act excludes that you would not believe. That it excludes, for instance, driveways, sidewalks, consequential damages. If they have to come back and it takes a month for them to come fix the defect that they, meaning the contractor, created, you're not entitled to additional living expenses to go live somewhere else and, you know, move into a hotel or whatever while they're doing that. And so those are the kinds of things that you could have excluded from the contract in the front end, or, you know, watered down to some degree. And so you really need to meet with an attorney and go over your new home contract. I just reviewed one this week, as a matter of fact, and it's just extremely contractor friendly. And listen, I represent a lot of contractors, and it's a negotiation. And at the end of the day, it's pretty fair to both parties. And, you know, that way it's a level playing field going in. And when it is a level playing field, there's less likely a chance for disputes arising that can't be resolved, because you've got a document that's going to give you the roadmap as to how to get it, you know, how to get it resolved.
All right. So it's probably a good idea, especially, you know, even if you just take an hour or so just to take a look at an agreement for a new house or a renovation and bring it to an attorney and have them, you know, sort of tighten it up for you. Because I've heard a renovation or a construction contract has been defined as a series of catastrophes that end in a finished product. Is that that's one definition I've heard by a lawyer. So
legislature, right?
It's just a lot. It's a lot of moving parts, and you just want to get it all together. All right, with hour number one is in the can. We're here till 10 o'clock, so we'll be back for hour number two. We'll talk about elections and consequences and how may affect the law next. Hey, we're back. Doug Sinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. Hour number two, we're on till 10 o'clock. You can also join us on our Facebook page. And if you'd like, type a question or comment, and we'll work you in. And, you know, Albert, I guess, first of all, you know, when we have, I think we had a presidential election just recently, if my memory reminds me. We had the humble, affable, laid-back Donald Trump against the slumbering and cognitively questionable Joe Biden. Is that probably? And so, you know, a lot of people, and I believe there's been a winner declared, and so we got to look to the future, right? And a lot of and I've had some people say, well, how is this going to affect, you know, state planning, and, you know, what should I do, what should not do, and some of the concerns and some of the things that were being put on the table to pay for this incredible debt that we have right now. And so there's people who are concerned about, you know, the death tax, which probably doesn't affect 99.9% of the citizens. The death tax is $11.7 million this year, meaning you won't be taxed on your first $11.7 million of your estate, which probably doesn't apply unless you're on a football team.
And then if you're married, it's your 11.7 of your wife or your husband.
Right, so you double that, so that'd be 23.4.
Over $23.
Yeah, the $23.4 million. And so most people are not too worried about that. I mean, there's talk about maybe lowering that. But there's also something called a stepped up basis. And well, first of all, we're talking about this, and my general advice is don't do anything now. You got plenty of time, you know, as far as maybe looking on how to plan. You know, just watch what goes through Congress, because trying to predict what policies will be passed is like trying to predict a horse race. You know, I mean, you know, you just don't know. You know, there's a lot of variables involved. But I think there is a concern that taxes are going to be raised, that taxes may be raised on estates, on certain, you know, tax rates are going to, on maybe capital gains on stocks and that sort of thing will be raised. But one of the things that was sort of interesting that's being put on the table is the stepped up basis for property inherited, for stocks or a property that's inherited in an estate. Now, for example, we're not talking about the death tax, okay? We're not talking about the $11.7 million exemption. We're talking about a different type of tax, because, you know, one thing the United States is very good at is taxing everything. I was saying they tax everything but breathing, but now they're taxing that because that's a carbon tax. But, you know, if way estates work now is, let's say dad or a parent bought Apple stock at $10 back in 2000. And now, I'm just using an example, it's worth $100 today. Okay? if I, you know, and parent sells that stock, they would be basically paying capital gains between the gain between the $10 or $100. So if he bought, he or she bought 10,000 shares of Apple stock at $10 back in 2000, that would be worth $100,000. And if they sold it, you know, and it was worth $100, 10,000 shares at a million, you'd be paying tax, capital gains tax on that $900,000. So it's a pretty easy concept. But when a person passes, they get what is called a stepped up basis. Meaning, I wish I had a chalkboard, but I don't. So I'm going to try to paint a visual chalkboard. Is that parent or decedent buys a stock for Apple stock for $10, 10,000 shares, it's worth $100,000. And then the decedent dies, and this stock is worth $100, which would make that stock worth $1 million for 10,000 shares. And then the legatee would inherit that stock and then subsequently sell it for $110, which would make it valued at $1,100,000. You can get that in your brain. Well, one of the proposals that is being discussed by the tax-loving legislature or Congress is that in that situation, as of now, if someone who inherited that stock would pay taxes on it, the basis for that tax would be $1 million, because you would get a stepped up basis when there's a death and a stock goes through an estate. So in other words, if you have a stock that was purchased for $10, Apple stock for $10,000, then the decedent died and it was worth $100, and then the heir gets the stock and sells it at $110, they would only be paying taxes on the difference between the $1 million and the $1,100,000, or the basis of the stock upon death, not where the basis upon when the stock was purchased. So in this case, the basis would be based on $100 instead of $10, even though the stock was purchased at $10. But one of the things they're talking about in Congress is, and it's sort of a below-the-radar tax that's not, you know, that's sort of not visually, you know, known until you deal with an estate, is that if someone inherits a stock, they want to tax, if you ever sell that stock, they want to tax or make the basis of, based on the time it was purchased, and eliminate that stepped up basis. Now it's hard to explain over the radio, but basically you lose that stepped up basis is one of the proposals on to raise money to pay for this incredible debt. So you know a lot of times in, you know, estate planning, you know, you might have a, you know, person who's a decedent who or up in age and state said, hey, you know, I'd like to sell the stock. And you say, you're probably better off not doing it and just letting it go through your estate, because you'll get a stepped up basis and you wouldn't have to pay capital gains on it or other assets. So one of the things just to watch is whether that proposal is put forth by the Congress in Washington. Because that would be very significant. What? Did I say socialist? I'm sorry. I take that back.
The Republicans aren't promoting that. The Democrats are.
Yeah. Well, Well,
we'll know that elections have consequences.
Well, and that's what I was saying, is that a lot of, you know, people who have, you know, are the average demographics of our show is 59, age 59, and they go to church and, you know, probably half of them going to church right now. And, you know, so, you know, they have businesses and they've accumulated, and they're saying, gee, what adjustments do I have to make based on this new administration and what they're likely to do and or may do? And my general advice right now is keep an eye on the legislation that's going to be proposed. And then by, I'd say, September, August, November, you'll have a pretty good idea as to what adjustments would you'd have to make. And,
but Doug,
you know,
there's no legislation being proposed. It's all by executive order.
Well, I know now is, but you, as far as the taxes, there's a bunch of executive orders, which that's another issue that is more of a constitutional issue. But for the businessman who is our business, you know, person who accumulated a nice estate and would like to have it go to their children, is, you know, they're being concerned. I've receive call, concern, what do I do? What do I do to preserve the state? Should I start putting money in trust, irrevocable trust, and that sort of thing? Start getting the money, you know, start moving the money so it won't be taxed when I die. And my general advice right now is just keep an eye on what's going on in the Congress, what's going on, some of the proposals that are being made. And then by the summer, early fall, it may be time to, you know, depending on what's passed and what's not passed, to start making adjustments. Because the good part about this is lawyers work a lot quicker than the legislature. So as soon as they put, you know, legislation down, we start figuring out what we can do to mitigate the harshness of being, you know, of certain taxes and certain type of, planning. And so, you know, I guess, we're, you know, lawyers, accountants are pretty agile when it comes to it once the rules are made. But, you know, just sort of take, you know, just keep an eye out. I think there are going to be some changes, and it's going to be, you know, have effects. Yeah, Albert.
No, I agree. And you can expect that the inheritance tax
is going to be lowered.
Federal state tax will be lowered. Yeah. The number I've been hearing is anywhere between 3 and 3.5 million.
Yeah.
Which is still a pretty high number. It doesn't affect most people. But you know, if you worked hard all your life and you have a small business and you've got 20 or 30 employees and, you know, you've got assets, you own your building, you own your home, you're going to start adding all these things up, you know, you can get there. And then if your company's worth $10 million and you're going to have to pay 40-50% tax on the difference, yeah, you may have to sell your company to pay the taxes and to put all those people out of work.
Right.
And so there's just, you know, and then just shut your business down and be done with it. So there's, you know, some planning that needs to be done. You know, maybe start getting some things in your children's names before they grow. You know, setting up an LLC or a corporation.
Yeah,
where it's all in the children's names, but you maintain the voting rights
and the control of it. But
you control it. You run the company, and you know, upon your death, it transfers to them, and then they, you know, there's an operating agreement that decides who runs this and or how to vote on that, et cetera. And you know, then all of a sudden, the growth of the company becomes theirs and not yours. It just gets turned over to them.
Yeah, so we got to go to break, and I apologize for referring to the congressman who want to tax us to death, a socialist. I apologize. So let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Linda. Linda, you on all things legal. What can we do for you?
Well, I was hoping you could help me settle a credit card or two credit cards that I've been on a long-term payment plan for a few years now. And I called when we got our stimulus check. I thought, oh, I'll never have this money again. Let me see if I can just pay these two credit cards off.
Yeah.
Just see if they would settle for half of what I owe. And one said, no, we cannot negotiate. And the other one said, well, you can put it in an application, but the most that they've ever taken off would be 10%. Any doubts that they would take off?
Well, that's not true. Most they hadn't taken was 10%. That's not true. What I would suggest you do this is ask for a supervisor and keep going up the chain.
I did. It took all day to get through to an actual supervisor.
Yeah, it takes a while. That's one we have done. Here's another thing that we have done, and we've done this through an attorney. And you could write a letter stating, now you probably want to have an attorney do that for you, is write a letter to an attorney saying that, hey, let's say I have an outstanding balance of, you know, $8,000. I'm making a proposal that I'll pay $4,000 for it. if you do not agree to accept this as a full and final settlement of my account, please return the check for further negotiation. However, if you do cash the check and you endorse it, then that constitutes full and full satisfaction of my account. And then you write on the back of the check, endorsement of this check constitutes full and final settlement of the account listed, you know, and put the account number on there. That is one way we have done that to address that issue. And if they cash the check, then you argue that, hey, you should have set the check back. That was the terms and conditions of cashing this check. That's one thing you could try to do.
But
a lot of times after they do that, they don't credit it that way. And you say, well, you know, come sue me because I have a defense, which I think would be upheld. But you have to be very specific in the letter stating that if you endorse this check, that constitutes full and final settlement of my account, and you can't come back and ask for anything more. If you disagree with these terms and conditions, send me back the check for further negotiation. Now, a lot of times they figure, rightfully so, that a bird in a hand is better than two in a bush. So that's one thing that's done. We typically do that with a lot of estates that we end up, you know, if a estate has liquidation problems, we will settle for that.
And Albert, keep in mind, who do I know where to send this letter in this check?
Well, yeah, Albert, you want to?
Well, what I was going to say is keep in mind that at this point in the process, that debt has probably been sold. That debt has probably been sold to a collection agency, and we're going to turn you over to a collection agency. What that means is the collection.
Well, no, they didn't say that because I called them on Thursday, and they said I still need to keep making the minimum payments. That they don't. One doesn't negotiate, and the other one said they might settle for 10% off.
Yeah. Let me tell you something about Albert.
If you are making the payments, then they have no real incentive because they're going to collect 100% of the debt, and they don't care if they collect it now, if they collect it in 2 years. But if you haven't been payments and you all of a sudden, you know, you come along and you say, look, I can pay you this now and nothing else, then they'll, believe it or not, you know, they're more likely to make a deal because they're thinking, you know, we're going to have trouble trying to collect this in the future. Keep in mind, like I said, that at this stage of the litigation or this stage of the process, that debt has been sold to a company. That's all they do is they buy these debts from these credit card companies, and they're the ones that are collecting the money from themselves. So every nickel or dime that they knock off, you know, they knock off money that's coming right out of their pocket because they've already paid the credit card company, you know, 30, 40, 50 cents on a dollar.
If that much, right.
Can you recommend a lawyer that I can go to? Because I don't know how to do this. I just recently retired or semi-retired, and I can barely make ends meet.
Just give us a call at 837-1304, 837-1304, and we will point you in the right direction.
Say that number again.
504-837-1304. Yes.
1304.
That's it. All right. Okay. Thanks for the call, Linda. Let's go.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to Oscar. New Orleans got a question. Hey, Oscar, you know all things legal with Dex and Sarah and Albert Nico.
Doug and Al, how you guys doing?
Good. Thanks, Oscar.
Hey, look, man, I'm just calling to congratulate you guys. 13 years. I'm glad you let me through, you know.
Thank you.
13 years, you guys last longer than my marriage. Yeah, it's okay. What do you think of this?
Well, as you said, Oscar, I don't know any Oscars. I know an OT.
I know most people call me OT, but man, I want to congratulate you guys. 13 years, you guys lasted longer than my marriage, man. What's up with that?
OT, let me ask you: are you still playing music? You still with the bench warmers?
Yeah, still playing music, but you know, right? You know, we've been shut down since March. Well, you know, I mean, it's what it is.
I know OT is part of the Jesuit team that lost to St. Aug in 1979. Right?
No. I graduated in 78.
Did you?
Before that.
You missed that. I thought you were part of that. But
yeah,
you're
no, it's okay.
That's okay. But you were reared in Bucktown, right?
Well, you know, right there, I say you were, off the skirts. You know, Homestead Vets right there by Bonneville.
Oh, that's you can go either way on that there, you know. You go either way.
Exactly. But, you know, Lakeshore Playground, Lakeside Country Club, you know, all the good places, you know.
There you go. Good to hear from
you. I don't want to keep you guys long. I just want to congratulate you guys, you know, 13 years and, you know, hopefully another 13 for you guys, you know.
Sounds good, OT. All right, brother.
All right, buddy, you guys have a good one. All righty.
OT, real quick. OT, where you go? Hello? You still
there? I think he's gone. But he's listening.
Okay. Well, I wanted to find out his take on the whole, you know, live music shutdown and you know, how that's affecting things. And, you know, I mean, we got people up on stage and it's just, I don't know. I don't want to get into it. But I just want to get an idea of what, you know, how it's impacted him and all the other, you know, live musician artists that, you know, that make up this city and make this city what it is. And they've just been, on hold for almost a year now, you know, because of all this.
Well, you know, elections have consequences. So we'll see. In about 10 months if that changes. Let's go to Michelle's got a question. Well, Michael's got a question in Mandeville regarding eviction. Hey, Michael, you and all things legal.
I just got a quick question about evictions on rental property.
Mm-hmm.
If a property is owned outright, this moratorium and all this still affects it, right? So even though you don't have a loan with the government or with a bank or anybody, you own it outright, you still have to follow the protocol, right?
Correct. Yeah, I don't think it matters one way or the other. I think the issue is protecting the tenant from being homeless, right? Because, you know, again, I'm sure you're aware of the government form that they have to fill out and the assertions that they have to make regarding their income, regarding the fact that they lost their job for COVID-related reasons. There's a litany of things that they have to attest to. And so if you give them that form and you know somehow or can prove somehow that they're not being truthful, nothing would prevent you from going in and saying, hey, look, I want to still go forward with this eviction. And they represented to the court XYZ, and here's proof that that's not true. And so, you know, they are making an income. They are doing whatever they said that they're not doing. And I'm entitled to an eviction. And so
where do you get the form from?
It's on the government website. Just look up, moratorium or eviction moratorium. And it'll bring you to the government website. And then they'll have the rules and regs. And then there's a form there that says, look, if you're not paying me rent, you see, they're supposed to be trying to make payments too. And which, you know,
right.
They can't just walk away from it. So
feeling they're getting
back to me.
I get a feeling they're getting their stimulus checks and they're not, you know, using it for rent. They're using it for other stuff.
Wow. That's,
and
that's...
their lease has run out, you know, they're kind of month to month, but you know, here we are stuck in this pandemic and, you know, it's a hardship on landlords.
How many months have you been?
Probably six.
And they've paid zero?
Right.
Wow.
Common complaint, but we've made
as they can pay. So if you can find out some information about them, and listen, at this point, it might be worth hiring a private investigator, you know, seeing if they're going to work every day and, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, they might spend, you know, $1,000, but, you know, consider 6 months worth of rent if you can get them out. You know, and then the question is, can you get it re-rented? You know, that's the next step.
Right.
All right, Michael. What do you got any further questions?
Right,
give us a call at our law firm, 504-837-1304. Go to a break. Tuxin Terry, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. All things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Tuxin Terry, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. All things legal. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Jay. He's got a question regarding Medicaid. Jay, you on all things legal. What can we do for you,
bro? Thank you. My wife's mother is in a nursing home in New Orleans, and she was recently approved for Medicaid, so that that was one big hurdle. But now her residence, mm-hmm. uh, we which is uptown, like to dispose of that.
Oh, you can't. Don't do that.
That's what we want to know.
No.
It would go to her.
No, if you dispose of it, you see what happens is this: she'd lose her Medicaid eligibility. What happens is there's two type of assets that Medicaid considers. There's countable assets and non-countable assets. In order to be Medicaid eligible, you have to have less than $2,000 of countable assets, which is basically cash. All right.
Yeah. Met those thresholds.
Now the equity in a home is a non-countable asset. Now, if you sell the home and turn it from a non-countable asset to a countable asset, you're not going to be eligible. So here's the way it works. I always give this example. If someone has $3,000 of cash and no home, they're not eligible for Medicaid because they're over the threshold. But if someone has a $500,000 home that's paid off but no money, they're eligible. So a lot of people have made this mistake before, and if you want to stay Medicaid eligible, as soon as you sell that house and it turns into cash, you come off of Medicaid, long-term care.
Is there a way to arrange to have the money just go to Medicaid?
No. Well, I mean, I'll put it to you this way. No, it doesn't. As soon as you sell it, you come off Medicaid.
I have a couple of questions, Doug.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. So, did your mom and dad live in that house together?
They did. There was no will. Father's deceased. Succession was done on the father.
Your mom really only owns half
of
it. That.
Right. So half would go to the children. Half.
Correct. So what is the value of the house, you think?
About $300,000.
Nice.
Right, so you're still looking at $150,000 that she would then come into her estate that would be now a countable asset. Is there a family member that is at all interested in maybe moving into that house, a niece, a nephew, or anything like that?
One of her daughters is living in the house, but she would agree to move.
Well, see, but that would be ideal because even if you rent the house, then that's income from
that's
home,
income, right.
And that goes out towards your Medicaid eligibility. So the most ideal situation is to have your sister living in the house, or having her daughter living in the house, and pay the bills, pay the taxes, pay the expenses, and so it's a zero sum game at this point until such time as she passes away. And then, you see if they may have filed any type of lien, but it's a percentage of her half, so it wouldn't be a substantial.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the whole, right.
No, it wouldn't be the whole thing. Yeah, we were looking for an alternative here because the house is going to have to be maintained if it's not sold.
Well, whoever lives whoever lives there can maintain it.
Yeah, she's not going to be able to do that.
No, but if you get a third party to live there, a family member to live there, and if they maintain it. That would be
The daughter is living there. The family member is living there, Doug. But she's not going to be able to afford to do it.
She not.
So
yeah, and my wife has a power of attorney, but and brothers and sisters won't contribute to maintaining it. So the burden of expenses would be on my wife, and that's on our retirement income to try to manage that property until the mother is deceased. So we're wondering if there are any alternatives. To dispose of it, and from what sounds like telling me, there isn't. Got to maintain it.
Is it
your wife's mother?
Yeah.
Okay, and it's just her and her sister?
Sister, and she has two other siblings, but they're not going to contribute to maintaining the property.
They're not going to?
No.
Okay.
The burden is on my wife.
I would sit down and have a contract formed with the other three siblings and say, listen, I'm going to maintain the property and we're going to spend the money to do X, Y, Z. But at the end of the day, when it gets sold, I'm going to get X amount of money plus interest back out of the sale of the house. Mm-hmm. And that way, you're not taking a beating on it. You've got the company every year that you can give to them and say, look, I'm going to get 6% interest plus maintain the house,
you know, all this time. You know, and look, the other option is to you know, if you go ahead and sell it, you know, she may get kicked off of Medicaid and have to get
that's
back
what we're afraid
home,
of. So, yeah. We're not going that route.
Right. I mean, you know, you got $150,000 now.
You
got to
spend
do something.
Yeah.
So, but I would have I would make an agreement with your siblings. Listen, if y'all don't want to do this, I'll do it. You know, sister living in the house, you pay the insurance and taxes. We'll pay the maintenance, and then, you know, in exchange for you living in the house, that's your rent, right? And then we'll do the rest of it. But we're gonna get it back off the top when the house sells. Plus interest.
So we're going to have to spend up front and seek reimbursement later.
Yes, but with interest.
Okay.
Or lose the $150.
Hey, look, if you get a 6 or 7% interest rate on it and you deal, you're doing all right.
One question to clarify: if only one half is being occupied, the daughter's living there. If we rent out the other half,
no, that's income. That's income.
That's what I'm asking. Yeah,
that'd be income.
Can't do that either. Okay.
So, Doug, let me ask you this, though, Doug, and give me your opinion on it. If it's a double, right, and the children own half the house, why can't, you know, the mom?
I'll tell you. I mean, here's
run out that half.
I'm going to tell you why, because if your application gets held up for 9 months on that issue, the time you clear it up, it may be a moot issue. To me, when I do a Medicaid application, I want it to be clean. Because if there's a double interpretation, it gets caught up. It might be a year before you clear it up, and by the time you clear it up, it's already a moot issue. So I'm always trying to avoid that argument, because you might submit an identical application and have two different interpretations by two different caseworkers, and sometimes it takes 6 to 9 months to get it fixed. And so I always try to do an application where you're not going to have those problems, because if you know you could win the battle and lose the war.
Yeah,
on those type of issues. So, but I mean, technically, Albert, you know, you could make that argument, but if the first line of claims, you know, of intake people don't buy it, then you don't, then you have Medicaid cut off, and that's got its own implications. So until you get it redone. All right. Great questions, Jay. Call us at 837-1304 if you got any additional questions. Great, great questions. Common issue most, you know, a lot of baby boomers are experiencing. Let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. All right, Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. We're in the last segment. Let's go to John. He's got a question in Slidell. Hey, John, you're in all things legal.
Hey, how you doing? Thank y'all for taking my call. I want to find out. I had a couple of credit cards that had zero balance on them, and the credit card company closed them out themselves, which made my credit score drop.
Yeah.
And I want to find out if there's anything that I'm able to do about that. And if, you know, what's my options, because since they closed them out and I've never used them, and when I did use them, I had a zero balance on them, but like I said, they shut them out and now my credit score has dropped. And I couldn't understand why. I never called to close them out. They did it on their own.
You know, Albert, I don't.
Yeah, I'm not sure why. Happened.
I don't know. I'm not sure what, you know, as far as credit card repair, I don't know anything to say except to write it, maybe write a, in your dispute saying, exactly what you said, so that if anybody pulls it, you know, they'll know that. Or if you go to a bank and you apply for a loan, just have that information ready. Say, hey, look, I closed out a credit. They closed out a credit card and it dropped my score, and they'll consider that. But I'm not able to help you as far as specifics on that. All right, John. Sorry.
I appreciate it. Thank you, buddy.
Thanks. Okay, let's go to Christian. He's got a question regarding property transfer. Hey, Christian, you're in all things legal. Got a couple of minutes. Be quick.
Hey guys, just had a question. I own a home personally, and formed an LLC. Want to turn it into a rental property. Uh-huh. Would like to see if you guys could kind of describe the process of transferring ownership from me personally to the LLC.
Albert,
what that entails.
You basically do an act of donation or an act of transfer, either one, where you donate the property to the LLC or you transfer the property into the LLC as a capital investment into the LLC, and then you record it in the. They said you're calling from Arizona.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Are you in Arizona?
The home's in Louisiana.
Oh, the home's in Louisiana. Yeah. So you'd record that act in the parish where the real estate's located, and then recite in the act where the tax statement is to go, et cetera. And then at that point, and the title will accurately reflect that the LLC owns the property.
And how does that affect the mortgage?
Well, you would need to check with your mortgage company. It usually does not. I mean, mortgage companies are pretty familiar with people placing the property into LLCs for liability protection. Check with your insurance agent, though, because sometimes it's a little bit different with them with respect to insuring a company and as opposed to an individual. Even though it is a rental and both parties are going to be utilizing it as a rental, it might be a different policy, so check with them and be sure you got that straight as well.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call.
All right.
Got about a minute to go. Albert, it's the first Sunday without football. So
like next Sunday.
Huh? Who do I like?
Yeah.
Tampa. And I will take the points. I like Tampa.
How many points? It's like 3.5 or something?
Yeah. I mean, and I'm sort of – I don't know why. It has nothing to do with being analytical about this. Because if I was looking at this analytically, I would take Kansas City in a second. But I think Tampa has peaked at the right time. Because basically in the playoffs – you know, you play from September to November to get into the playoffs. But what you do from September to November, once you get in the playoff, doesn't matter. It's because when are you peaking is the most important aspect of it. So
sure.
I think that Tampa's just got an intangible thing. I love their coach. Bruce Arians is a phenomenal coach. And so, that's sort of a risky thing, but a risky deal, but.
Boy, Tom Brady's the greatest ever. And I've been saying that for years, and nobody can argue that the greatest ever.
And I think they have the type of offense that when you play Kansas City, you're gonna have to grind it out. And if you get in a track meet with them, you're gonna lose. And you need that kind of offense that can eat it up, hold the ball for 35, 40 minutes, and be very tactical and targeted, and it's sort of controlling the tempo of the game. So. I have no reason to do it, no analytical or cognitive reason to do it, aside from the fact that it's just a gut feeling. So who you like, Albert?
I can go either way. I think Kansas City's got to have the edge. I mean, speed kills. They got four receivers that run under a 4.4 40, and so it's just hard to stop that. And if the quarterback's healthy, it's going to be a hard win, even for who's surprised the world,
All right. So we'll see. We'll talk about it next week. All right. Thank you, Albert. See you next week. Be good. Be blessed. See you next week on All Things Legal.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.